vaccinated against COVID-19 doesn't protect you from this. Or this.
Mom, what's for dinner?
Not this. This.
And it's looking like rain, rain, and more rain for this weekend.
This. Or even this.
Your call is important to us. Please hold.
But being vaccinated does protect you from the virus. Vaccination is still your best form of protection. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. In this episode, we're going to hear a program organized by the Adela Justice Project and the American Friends Service Committee earlier this month, marking the Land Day anniversary and the beginning of Ramadan. The first Land Day in Palestine took place on March 30, 1976, when Palestinians organized large demonstrations and a nationwide strike against Israel's plan to seize Palestinian land to build Jewish-only settlements. They were met with brutal Israeli repression and the massacre of six Palestinians. On Land Day in 2018, more than 100,000 Palestinians joined the historic Great March of Return in Gaza to protest Israel's inhumane blockade and demand that millions of Palestinian refugees be given the freedom to return to their homes. This year, the Islamic holy month of Ramadan began on April 1st. The day before, on Land Day, the Israeli government unleashed a new round of violence on Palestinians. In the program you'll hear, Palestinian activists from Gaza, the West Bank, and 1948 Palestine shared their reflections and analysis of the current situation on the ground across Palestine and what recent moments of popular resistance mean in the broader context of the Palestinian struggle. First, Adam Horowitz, Mondo Weiss's executive editor, talks with Sandra Tamari.
Sandra Tamari is a Palestinian-American organizer and the executive director at the Adela Justice Project, a Palestinian advocacy organization based in the U.S. that aims to shift public discourse and policy on Palestine. Welcome, Sandra.
Thanks, Adam.
On April 1st, Adela Justice Project and the American Friends Service Committee organized an extremely interesting event that we're going to be lucky enough to share with our listeners today. That event was called the Great March of Return to Unity Intifada, and it featured Soher Assad, Mariam Barghouti, and Ahmed Abu Artema. The event marked two important dates, Land Day and the anniversary of the Great March of Return. And I was wondering if you could share some about the significance of these anniversaries, why you chose to have this event on this day, and a bit of why you chose these speakers in particular.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. We've been thinking a lot about this long trajectory of Palestinian resistance. You know, a lot of people remarked that last year, the Unity Intifada was the first time that Palestinians across Palestine had united in resistance since the Great Arab Revolt of 1936. That's an extraordinary thing, you know, that a century later, nearly a century later, you have Palestinians going back to the source of the issue, going back to the crux of the issue, which is really about land. Settler colonialism is about exploiting the people and pushing people off the land. And, you know, what the Great March of Return did was really center again the right of return, the right to return of all those refugees in Gaza who make up 80% of the population, who are just from places just over that barrier fence. That can see those places, right? That they're so the memories of that those villages, the memories of that place is not that far back, from 1948. Their grandparents are from there, their parents are from there, and so really this idea that Palestinians across Palestine are dealing with exactly the same thing, this resistance to settler colonialism, and land, getting land back, being able to go back to their homes. That's simple. The reason we chose these speakers is because they do represent this thinking. And, you know, they address this in this podcast that you'll hear. They are people who are fighting fragmentation, who are framing this issue in these terms. Soher Assad, who is a human rights attorney and feminist organizer based in Haifa, has long been a teacher of mine and really, you know, helping us to understand that, you know, wherever we are as Palestinians, we are under the boot of Israeli oppression, including those of us here in the diaspora. So really pushing us here in the U.S. to take leadership in the U.S. movement. When you think about Maryam Barghouti and what she refers to as a new lexicon and a new conversation that's happening across geographies, you know, this is very much a part of her thinking. And obviously, Ahmed Abu Arteima, who was the inspiration behind the March of Return, you know, talking about how we're all dealing with exactly the same issues. Like Gaza, as we have been trying to assert at the Adala Justice Project, Gaza is not an exception. It's not a singular issue. Gaza is Palestine. That's the name of our campaign. And, you know, we all are facing, you know, different extremes of Israeli violence at different times. But the logic of the settler colonial regime remains the same regardless of where we live.
My next question, just in terms of kind of setting the context, and you've already sort of referred to this when you mentioned the new lexicon that Mariam refers to. But like I said, the title for this event sort of bracketed as a moment in time from the Great March of Return to the Unity Intifada. And it seems like we are in this new moment. And I was just wondering how you would characterize that moment. What makes this lexicon new, or what defines this moment?
Well, I think the most important part of this moment is the conversations that are happening across geographies. I know that those things were happening before, but they're happening in new ways, in new frameworks. I think Soher gives a really important example of how Palestinians from the 1948 territories, citizens of Israel, have always thought of themselves as facing, you know, a struggle for equality, a struggle for voting rights, a struggle for civil rights within Israel, and how that has changed so dramatically, really, in the last, you know, few years, as people begin to understand their position, right, within Israeli society, begin to understand how Israel's apartheid regime is the same, regardless of the position, regardless of your citizenship status. We see this so dramatically in the Naqab. We see this so dramatically in places in the Galilee. And people are beginning to frame their issues the same way that they see the issues of West Bank settlements and the same way they see the siege of Gaza. So I think that that's one important way. I think that the Israeli regime has become more, let's say, more clear in its objectives, right? Palestinians have always understood the Israeli regime has wanted. But I think because they've become so bold in their racism, so bold in their motivations and aims, that it's very difficult for Palestinians to sort of sit on the fence and think that somehow that they can be, you know, good citizens, good liberals, make a living and somehow survive. I think that that's part of it as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
Part of our commitment to centering Gaza in our conversations. Gaza is Palestine and Gaza Unlocked. And it doesn't mean that Gaza is separate. It doesn't mean that Gaza is an issue that we deal with seasonally at times of active bombardment, but it means that we don't leave Gaza to the side. Gaza is always at the center of our conversations because Gaza represents the ultimate demand of the Palestinian people, which is land in return. The Unity Intifada in May of 2021, as we all remember, was a mass mobilization of Palestinian resistance across Palestine, the scope of which we haven't seen since the Arab Revolt of 1936, which was massive resistance to British mandatory control of Palestine and Zionist influx of immigration to Palestine and confiscation of land. It's always been about the land. Today, as I said, marks 4 years since Gaza's Great March of Return, a historic uprising in Gaza that expressed not the need for food, not the need for economic change, but a very basic demand, the freedom to go home. And today also marks Land Day. In 1976, Palestinians organized large demonstrations and a nationwide strike broke out against Israel's continuing plans to expropriate large swaths of Palestinian land for Jewish-only settlements. All of these periods of resistance were met with brutal Israeli repression. And here we are, you know, 1 year out from the wondrous Unity Intifada that spread across the homeland last year, tying again every geography of Palestine with a single cry. We are one people, and this is one land. Nonviolent resistance in Palestine, led by a new generation of youth, has been met by tremendous suppression of the Israeli occupation and Palestinian security forces alike. But it's important to remember that we Palestinians are not alone in fighting against annihilation and settler colonialism. I'm really pleased to say that today our native family here on this continent, Turtle Island, who are 500 years into their struggle for freedom, have issued yet another symbolic and concrete symbol of their solidarity and love for us. Our friends at Indian Collective just now are releasing a position paper committing Indian country solidarity with Palestine. And we will have some information for you in just a moment, where we invite you to join Indian Collective's Land Back team, Crystal Tubles, Nadia Tanous, and Demetrius Johnson, for a live conversation at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, where they will be talking about this historic statement. But turning back to today's conversation, I want us to remember that moments of resistance, like the March of Return, like the Unity Intifada, like Land Day, are not only distinct events that are responding to Israeli aggression, they paint a historic pattern of social change and revolution that prove that these underlying, that show that underlying patterns of transformation are what bring us closer to freedom and decolonization. Our resistance is constantly building, and we are learning with each iteration. In this conversation today, we have representation from Gaza, from 48, and the West Bank. And we hope to investigate what these patterns look like, what lessons we've learned from these courageous moments of uprising, and how we can best here in the US support Palestinians against Zionist repression and violence. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Ahmed Aburtema, Suher Asad, and Miriam Barghouti. Ahmed was one of the lead organizers of Gaza's Great March of Return, and he is a writer and journalist based in Gaza. Suher Asad is a feminist organizer and human rights attorney based in Haifa. And Miriam Barghouti is a writer and organizer based in Ramallah. Welcome to you all. Ahmed, I'd like to turn to you first. Can you tell us what inspired you to organize the Great March of Return and what you feel was accomplished through the march?
Thank you for this opportunity, and thank you for everyone. Yes, the first motivation was that we as humans, we need our freedom. We need to feel that we can live normally like the other peoples. You know, Gaza actually, it's not only a prison, but it's a small prison. You can cross Gaza Strip from the sea to the fence, and that on the taxi only on 10 minutes. So it's very limited. And here are 2.3 now. They are 2.3 million people in just 1.41 square miles. And there is an Israeli blockade here. The Israeli authorities control everything, the movement of the people, the movement of the patients to access to the hospitals, the entering of the goods. So the life here is a slow death. It's like a slow death. So also at that year, on 2018, there was a lot of speaking about Trump's plan and how that plan targets the right of the return. And you know, the right of the return is the essence of the Palestinian rights, of the Palestinian cause. So no one of the Palestinians can negotiate on this right. So all those factors and reasons make the environment is ready to for this idea, the idea of the protesting near the fence ready. So at that time, you know, I think the majority of you now know the story. When I wrote on my Facebook that post, so it wasn't only because the post was unnormal or powerful, but because of the environment was ready for this movement. So the tens of the activists at that time reacted with this idea, and after that civil society and the, all the contacts of the Palestinian society in Gaza. On March 30, 2018, like this day today, we saw 100,000 more protesters near the fence, including all the Palestinian factions, all the Palestinian parties, including the elderly people, the children, the women. All of them were protesting at that day to renew their belief in their right to return and to make their voice heard for the world, that we cannot adapt with this slow death, but we need our freedom. We need to break this fence, to break this blockade. It was a scream of life, a scream of freedom, and it was a strong message that even after 70 years, the Palestinians. Didn't forget their right to return to their homes. And you know, about 70% of the Palestinians here in Gaza, they are refugees, including me personally. I'm a refugee from Ramla. It's now in what's called Israel, and I never visited there. Just before a few days, Israel was trying, and until now, trying to bring the Ukrainian Jews to come to Israel and to stay here, maybe in Ramla or in Jaffa or in Naqab. In the same time, me as a native Palestinian in this land, I never visited my homeland where my grandfather lived there. So this is injustice, and this what make the people, the Palestinian people, feel deeply in their hearts that they must break this reality. They must revolt in this reality. And I think the march of return in this day, March 30, was only one part in a long series of the Palestinian people to continue their struggle, to continue their refusal to adapt with the Israeli colonization, and to ask their normal right to live normally and to have their freedom.
Thank you so much, Ahmed. That was so clear and so powerful. Thank you so much. Soher, I'm gonna turn to you. You were part of solidarity demonstrations in Haifa with the Great March of Return. I remember that very well. And during the resistance last year, Palestinians in 48 were in full resistance mode, rising with the uprisings across Palestine. As we all know, the Israeli state has come under the complete control of the far right wing, which sees no need to even play the games it used to play with the old lies of, you know, being a democratic and Jewish state. Can you describe the situation now in 48 Palestine and how things have changed since last year's Unity Intifada?
Yeah, thank you, Sandra. And thank you, Ahmed. I want actually to build on what Ahmed started with, the March of Return. And I think it's a key point to understanding what happened in the last few years and to understanding what happened during the Unity Intifada. And I think this sense of Gaza has been living under the siege for years, and every life in Gaza is impacted by this siege and by the continuous wars and violence and a huge amount of oppression That Gazans are experiencing. And I think the moment of the Great March of Return for us was not only the moment of popular resistance, but also the moment in the level of discourse that we're taking back again to the root causes. So for years, we've heard the conversation about stopping the blockade in Gaza, maybe bettering a little bit the condition of people. But what was the most inspiring is people and there's like actually bringing out a discourse around, okay, we want to return. Us being refugees, us being living under this siege is the root cause for all the suffering. And of course, we've seen the Israeli response to that, the Israeli very violent response to that. And we've seen also at the same time the hope, we've seen the inspiration, and we've seen the ability of Palestinians elsewhere to link it also to link this, to be able to see, despite the fragmentation and the different situations across Palestine, that this specific condition is a result of the bigger condition that all of us are experiencing. And I think this is very important in understanding the Unity Intifada and what happened after that. And I think Palestinians in 48 in the West Bank went out in the street in a similar context. In 48, we're used for years to look at 48ers as Palestinians who will go out in solidarity with other Palestinians. But rather, I think, and it's not accurate historically, if we're looking also at the Land Day and other historical events and the Second Intifada, this is how it was framed for us. This is how it was formed on us in order to keep this fragmentation and to make it look as we're in solidarity with another people, as those who are part of the citizenship framework inside Israel. But what actually we saw in the Unity Intifada, and I would not discuss that a lot because I need to move on to what happened later, is really this sense of agency of Palestinians, despite the years of defeat, despite disappointment from political parties and political fractions and Palestinian leadership, taking their agency into their hands and going to the street and from their own position, from their own pain, from their own experiences with poverty, with violence, with everything, with home demolitions and forced displacement, to link it to the wider Palestinian struggle. And this was the main thing for me in the Unity Intifada, not only Palestinians in different geographies, but our ability to imagine ourselves as part of a people and to see this amazing social solidarity internally and to imagine what it could like in a long process of a revolutionary process, not a one-time event. So Israel, of course, during and after the uprising, responded with a huge amount of oppression that I think is part of the pattern we're seeing in recent years, where the green line is, you know, disappearing totally, not only in the level of policies, but in the level of tools of oppression. And I think people heard a lot in the recent months about that. I wouldn't really go deeply, but I'm willing to take any question in that direction. But maybe we can speak about how this oppression is transforming now over the last period. I think, of course, we've seen in the uprising the issue of class as the one main issue in the two kind of the dynamics that Israel has taken in the recent years since the Second Intifada. One is oppression, material and direct oppression, and the other one is development and attempts to co-opt the Palestinian liberation struggle. And now this, usually we compare Palestinians class-wise vis-a-vis Israelis. So, but in this uprising, we've seen the huge gap that was created over these years internally, the class gap. And we've seen it play a main role in what happened in the uprising and after that. While people who are the most marginalized, those the working class people who we've seen younger women and men marching in the street, and of course, organizers and activists were targeted and continue to pay the price until now. We're speaking about around 2,000 arrests, more than 250 indictments, and it's continuing. Now, those who carry the burden, it didn't stop in May. It didn't stop in June. People are still on trial. People are facing years of incarceration. The last two cases in Akka were 7 years in prison and 4 years in prison for guys who were marching the streets during May. The families continue to pay the burden. Those are families who live in poverty. So many times those are single moms whose their sons are the only ones who can provide for the family. So this kind of dynamic also shows us where the pain and who continues to pay the price today. While at the same time, the second pattern that we're witnessing is the continuation of the policies of development, aiming at taking this uprising again out of its context, framing it as a question of equality and social and economic rights under the citizenship framework, and in a way, turning it into a discussion between a political elite on the scale of like kind of reforms inside this kind of framework. Of course, there are who took it very far in a way that is working against the interests of the Palestinian people, against justice and liberty and equality for us. And we've seen Palestinians inside the Israeli government taking this role actually under the pretext of development and of more rights. And of course, the classical kind of framework of politics that still didn't break out of the citizenship framework. Now, I think another thing I want to mention in the level of oppression, and I'll try to end, in the uprising, we've seen Israeli settlers marching the streets looking for Palestinians in 48 to murder them or to attack them. And Israel was claiming that these are far right wing, that they are not part of the military or security apparatus of Israel. And we always claim that they are part of it. These are settlers, these are part of this community that is built on these values, and they're fully protected by the system. What we've seen lately, especially after the events in Naqab, the forced displacement and the amazing popular resistance we've seen, a new militias of right-wing Israelis being forming in formation, and actually in a response to the killing of an Israeli soldier in Gaza. So they're seeing the links, and their claim is that in the south, in Gaza, in Naqab, things got out of control, and therefore they need civilians in these militias, and it's under the police. They are volunteers under the umbrella of the police, and they clearly are saying their racist approach to Palestinians, and they function under this official protection. I'll finish by saying that what we need now, we've seen how Palestinians took political agency, how we kind of didn't wait for the classic Palestinian political organizing spaces, but now we're in the formation of something else. This something else is in process, is getting built. Of course, I'll speak about it maybe more later, but our main task is to keep the spirit of social internal solidarity of people taking back their agency on our liberation against settler colonialism, but also our internal liberation as internal justice for women, for working class, for everyone who is part of this Palestinian society. And of course, to hold unity, not only in the level of geographies, but unity in the level of imagining our struggle and imagining a free Palestine. Thanks.
Wow, Suher, always you managed to thread so many pieces of the fabric together in such a beautiful way. Thank you so much. Miriam, I think that Suher has set you up very nicely. Welcome to you. We are going to turn a little to another huge obstacle we face. I know you were on the streets last year confronting Israeli occupation forces, but you also came up against Palestinian Authority forces. In July 2021, in the wake of the Palestinian Authority's assassination of Nizar bin Nat, you said that the Palestinian Authority now is acting like a police state without the state. We know that since the signing of Oslo, this has been the dilemma of us Palestinians, especially those in the West Bank, fighting both Zionist settler and state forces while confronting a Palestinian leadership that collaborates with our occupiers. Can you help us paint a picture of the current situation from your perspective in Ramallah?
Yeah, thank you, Sandra. And thank you for both Ahmed and Suher. For just being eloquent and having the mental labor and energy really to re-say that and revisit these moments in our present, I suppose, not really our past. When it comes to the Palestinian Authority, I think I want to emphasize two things. The first is that this is not a dilemma. Sorry, the phone. The first is that this is not a dilemma. We're not stuck between on whether or not we should confront and challenge the Palestinian Authority. We know we should. We know we want to. If you speak to the large majority of Palestinians, even those that work within the Palestinian Authority framework, that their salaries rely on them, are very critical of it in the sense that they're not sustainable for any future that we want to hold as Palestinians. The dilemma that we're facing is how can we shake up the status quo, basically reclaim and take back a lot of power that's been taken by the Palestinian Authority on our behalf, and moving towards a more representative, meaningful future that is just and equal for Palestinians themselves, right? Because as Suhair was mentioning, the classism issue, and these are things we need to start considering post-liberation, what is our reality going to look like? But how do we do that against the PA while still trying to remain protected, while still trying to feed your five kids a meal at the table and make sure that they're going to go to school? And all, so these are the things that are standing really in our way. It's the banalities of life and just this very instinctive yearning to continue and build a future, right? So that's where the Palestinian Authority comes in. It's really serving its role and the position that it was meant to serve, ideally during the Oslo Accords. The Palestinian Authority wasn't meant to be an interim government for 5 years. It was meant to become exactly what it is, a police state without without the state. And what that leaves us with is police or armed security forces and internal problems. Right now, what we're having is the PLO and Fatah. For those that don't know, Fatah is a Palestinian faction that serves under the PLO, which is, quote unquote, the sole representative of the Palestinian people due to its armed resistance pre-Oslo in the 70s and 80s. So it's, how can we do that? How can we shift that dynamic while staying safe? Because right now they're fighting internally, the security apparatuses, the preventative security to the intelligence agencies. And each one is headed by someone different, from Hussein al-Sheikh to Majid Faraj to Dmeri. And there, it's as though as Palestinians, especially as youth, we're caught in the middle. It's we're here, we're saying, hey, all of this is really getting in the way of our liberation as we're actually in the street trying to do it. But you're here shooting at each other and also shooting at us. You know, for someone like me, completely factionless, I do not belong to any political faction. I don't believe in the legitimacy of Mahmoud Abbas. I don't believe in the legitimacy of Israel as an apartheid state and a colonial state. But at the same time, what keeps me from saying this so vocally? What keeps me from practicing this on the ground, from taking my West Bank ID and ripping it and saying, you know what, actually, I don't want to do the green color anymore. Until we figure out our own, you know, whatever system, I'm not going to do it. What stops me are the attacks. So Nizar Banat basically got assassinated, not for challenging the Palestinian Authority, not for running for municipal elections. He was killed for exposing the vaccine problem that the PA was doing with Israel, which put the entire population at risk. It put the entire Palestinian population at risk. And what terrified them was someone said something about it. And that's, I think, captures the crux of just how terrifying the PA is, which brings me to my final concluding remarks. And that is, it's at a very scary place, a place where it has learned how to draw impunity, just like Israeli settler militia have. And honestly, my hand is on my heart for what's coming this next spring and summer. As Suhair kind of pointed out, and Ahmed as well, things don't happen in a vacuum. You know, they're all precedented. And what comes next is only going to be, you know, to each reactions, there's an equal but opposite reaction kind of thing. So the higher that was, that means our response will also be higher, because the more they devalue our voice and our lives, the more we're going to value it. I mean, I think this is where the PA messes up, which leaves us in a very chaotic place. Yay.
Okay. Yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you, Miriam. You say it's not a dilemma. It certainly strikes me as a dilemma. Not the issue. Maybe the way I posed it. The dilemma is not whether we oppose them or not, but what do we do with the situation we're facing? I'm going to skip ahead because you brought it up, Miriam. We know that Ramadan and Nakba Day, which are upon us, Ramadan begins this weekend, are always times of increased violence from the Israeli state. We've seen this throughout history, and that confrontation is almost going to be inevitable because resistance comes, right? Whenever there is a, you know, whenever subjugation and oppression exist, resistance is inevitable. I wonder if you could speculate a bit, Mariam. I know that this is on your mind, on what we might be, what we should be looking for in the coming weeks and months.
So this is a really good point, right? And I think it's an important point of reflection for everyone really that's just following on Palestine. Every basically Ramadan, every summer, there's an intensification to the attacks by Israeli settlers as well as police and military, right? And I really think so, and you know, I humbly admit this, I think I had my own reductionist perspective on it. That, okay, it happens in the summer, there's Israeli elections, so they're gonna bomb us. But what is in reality happening, which allows me to kind of predict what's gonna happen, is Israel has been socially engineering our circumstances to ensure that we are provoked and respond in a very certain way, right? So the fact that everything happens, you know, almost every summer, will also require, like, I'm living in a state of anxiety. Most of us here, it's a very eerie, like, point. It's not calm at all. You're having, you know, different things happening, from attacks to increased military raids to detention to stabbings, also increasing in frequency. And the anticipated fear that I live in, now, just before anything big happens, right, before the media suddenly catches up, for us it's big, is going to make me also react in a certain way. So I'm going to have a preemptive reaction to that. I don't want to live last summer again. None of us do. You know, so it's like, what if that comes along? Are we going to have breath to survive it? Because we were managed to survive last summer and begin imagining. Right now, if we are crushed again, and this is what Israel has done in Gaza, that's what I mean by social engineering of circumstance. They placed the entire population under siege for 15 years, denied them nutrition, which impacts our mental well-being as well as our physical health. And that means it impacts our ability to innovate, to think, to create, to have spare time, to imagine together. And what's going to happen now is Israel is going to keep pushing it, and it is at a last limit. You know, it breaks my heart. But Palestine, we said it was at a last breath last time. Now it's on an oxygen machine. Has the potential, but it's on an oxygen machine. So attacks are going to increase. Israeli settler forces and militia are going to legalize and justify their increased attacks on Palestinians. They're going to come up with new charges, like they did last year, where the middle finger became a charge against the youth Sahid was talking about. And, you know, we're going to naturally react. Right now, the difference is, I think Palestinians were able to unify from last year. We were able to network. We were able to grow and give a new lexicon to each other. You know, something like social engineering of circumstance. I'm like, okay, I also want reparations for this. So it's, we're thinking in this trajectory. So I think it's going to be frightening, scary, bloody, but I also think a lot of really good things are coming out of it, of what's going to hit us next, but I'm still scared. So I hope that answers, Sandra. Sorry.
No, Habibti, I hear you. It is terrifying, and we feel for all of you on the front lines, and that's why we're here today, because we want to be prepared to support you. Ahmed, I want to come back to you. I know last summer was another very bloody and terrible time in Gaza. And I heard you speak recently, and you said that the people in Gaza have no horizon. There's no, you know, goalpost or resistance at this point. I wonder, can you say a little bit about the mood in Gaza and what people are thinking as we come on to the 1 year anniversary of the May 2021 attacks?
Yes, First, I would like to say hi for Maryam. And yes, okay. Hi, Maryam. Okay, and yes. Okay, yes, as you mentioned, no horizon in Gaza. And the people convinced more and more that the situation in Gaza is not independent. It's relating to all the situation in Palestine. And this means it will take long time to be solved. So we cannot say that one day the problem of Gaza will be ended. At the same time, there is a colonization in all of Palestine. So yes, you know, in the last May, it becomes more clear that how the Palestinians are connected everywhere. In the same time, in Gaza and Al-Quds and Akka and Lod and Naqab, in the same time, the Palestinians moved together. Yes, let me say the human situation, the human suffering is continuing in Gaza Strip. There are sometimes like attempts to isolate Gaza from the situation, because Israel look to the strategic problem not in Gaza Strip. The strategic problem in the view of Israel is in West Bank, the annexation, and in inside in the occupied Palestine 1948, where it commits the racial discrimination among the Palestinians there. Gaza is near Egypt, so Israel, in its thoughts, can think. It would like to make this, but it's not able to make this, to push Gaza toward Egypt and then end this problem. But the national awareness among the people in Gaza failed this Israeli strategy. I was asked one day from a radio that why you as Gazans are not happy with the Trump's plan. Trump's plan give you, as Gazans, give you economical opportunities and maybe more lands in Egypt or in Naqab. I said to them, I'm not a Gazan, I'm a Palestinian. So it's one problem when it comes to the settlement and the annexation and the racial discrimination everywhere. Yes, there are sometimes there are attempts from Israel to isolate Gaza from the situation. And this context, Israel allowed for about 20,000 workers from Gaza recently, just before a few days, to give them permits to go inside the occupied Palestine and to work there. But when it comes to the national level, we cannot say in the horizon a political solution for Gaza as Gaza. But we need to end this colonization. We need to work together to fail this apartheid regime. Then we can all, as Palestinians, we can get our freedom and our dignity.
Thank you so much, Ahmed. I see affirmation. I'm not a Gazan, I'm a Palestinian. This is a very important reminder. And this is really the impetus behind the Adala Justice Project Gaza is Palestine campaign. Thank you so much for painting that picture for us. Suhair, I want to come back to you. Maryam started to do a little bit of an analysis of what we've learned from the Unity Intifada, and she talked about how we've shared language, we've shared analysis, we've shared strategies. Could you reflect a little bit about how we're building and how you've seen the trajectory? Because you've talked about it, a citizenship framework toward an equality framework, toward an ending of settler colonialism across all geographies. Can you talk a little bit about what you're noticing building on last year?
Yeah. So I want to take us back to the actually the point where we discussed. So over this webinar, we've asked about the Great March of the Return, about the Unity Intifada, about the Nizar Banat demonstrations under the PA. And I think this is part of the Unity Intifada. This is part of the process. And this is part of the March of Return until these days that we are seeing. This is a continuation of this revolutionary process where we as Palestinians under different geographies and different legal regimes and different specificities in the level of oppression, but at the same time, as Ahmed said, we're not the 48 in the Gaza and the West Bank, understand the specific condition of each region, but we also understand the bigger umbrella. Now, how are we building on the Unity Intifada? I'll start the positive things and then I'll move maybe to the challenges. I think the main thing we're keeping in mind is not to lose the spirit of the moment. And it's, when I say spirit, it's not just, you know, a beautiful word. It means the spirit of really people in Palestine that for years we've been robbed of our right to be part of what is the legitimate politics, both locally and internationally. What is supposed to be, how can we speak about Palestine? What kind of political work is allowed around Palestine? And it was designed both among all Palestinians, but both under the specific conditions of each geography. And Ahmed spoke about Gaza, but also Maryam spoke about the Palestinian Authority. Maryam said it turned into a police. I think it never could be anything else. This is their job description. This is why they were created, to function under the Israeli colonialism as a way to control Palestinians, both with oppression, but also, again, there again we see capitalism and money with making Palestinians feel that resistance is very pricey, that we're linked to the system through this. And this happened in multiple areas, including in 48. So if we want to look at it, part of the complexity is the huge amount of powers that are working to oppress us. It's not only Israeli colonialism, it's also Palestinian political and economic elite that is part of this its project or now is benefiting from it. So it's continuing to compromise over justice and freedom for us. Or if it's a political elite that cannot break out of this of these limitations. Now, in the level of life, these different powers, including the global capitalist system in its manifestation in Palestine, including this kind of even more links between our oppressors in the region, and we saw the Naqab summit last week, and globally. So these different complex powers create a reality that is hard to anticipate. In 48, you could see the material direct oppression of Israel, but also the indirect one through poverty and crime and others. So for me, it's hard to imagine what's coming, but I'm seeing a process of revolutionary moment and oppression and attempts by Israel to co-opt this. And the way, and I see the fear, and I see the fear that Maryam spoke about, and I see the continuation of this suffering until now, but I also see the huge amount of hope in that moment that we realize the most marginalized about us. But those of us who have been in politics for years and were pushed to the sides and were faced with the claim that we are not rational, that we don't know how to play big politics, that were considered politics of power. And what we want to be doing is politics of justice. And I think in that sense, we kind of broke away from classic political organizing in Palestine and classic civil society organizing into a space that we're yet to explore. It's mostly, if you look at the uprising and what's happening, it's mostly individuals, groups that being forming. And of course, some groups that formed over the last years, like Talaat, like the queer movement in Palestine and other movements. And just younger men. Some of them even are in themselves in circles of crime or violence, but they finally realize what does this regime means to their daily life. So the question that is open for us, we cannot anticipate, yes, but we know what we need. We know how we should accumulate in this. We need this sense of a collective. We need to build this space for the different movements that are emerging against different causes, but under the biggest cause. And we need to build the infrastructures that will protect us in moments like Miriam said. And we saw that. We saw that with the many lawyers, with the many doctor volunteers, with mental health volunteers. We saw this with a beautiful, amazing woman who volunteered for detainees by creating, by cooking and selling those to fund the legal costs. We saw that in many shapes and forms. And we want to take this, this amazing power and build it in a way that can basically support our revolutionary process to come against all these powers and against this oppression that, again, I will say is on a global scale. So also, and I'll finish by that, for many years, I've been, Miriam, I, and I think Ahmed, all of us have worked in advocacy, and I had to say this over and over again. I cannot even say how many times I've said that. And for many years before the uprising, we felt that people have dictated to us the boundaries of how we speak about Palestine. And we've seen as those who are out of the context, that are not linked to the ground, because there is the sole representative of the Palestinian people. And finally, we feel that we are the ones who have the power on the ground, and they are the ones who have no connection to people's suffering and people's aspiration. So I think also this power of a new generation that is can reclaim political liberation, can reclaim what is the discourse around Palestine, and push it globally as part of links with other struggles that are happening. And we saw the hypocrisy in the Ukraine case. We saw how for so many years, what is now accepted and welcomed in that case of occupation was denied from us. And I think following the uprising and seeing that for us, there is no going back to compromises. We want to claim the full package. We want liberation, we want decolonization, we want justice, and we want freedom for us and for all of us, regardless where we are.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Living with the virus means remaining cautious. We must continue wearing a mask and washing our hands. At the first sign of symptoms, it's crucial to self-isolate and get tested. Those who have COVID-19 must respect the isolation period, since they can remain contagious for at least 10 days. Those most at risk for developing complications, either because of their age or because they're immunocompromised, must be especially careful. And for even better protection, get vaccinated. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
If I wanna treat this like this, yeah. If I wanna treat that.